Acts 14, 21 to 23, where we started off. And when they had preached the gospel to that city, and had taught many, or made many disciples, they returned again to Lystra and to Iconium and Antioch, confirming the souls of the disciples, and exhorting them to continue in the faith, and that we must through much tribulation enter into the kingdom of God. And when they had ordained them elders in every church, and had prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord on whom they believed. As I worked on this in preparation for today, I ended up with the same outline I used yesterday morning. I started out with a review, and so all I have is a review this morning, actually for the outline. But we talked about three phases, you might say, of the ministry. First, the preaching of the gospel. Secondly, the making of disciples. And thirdly, then the selection or the training of leadership. Preaching the gospel, having our own, some ministry that's the outflow of our own life to the non-Christians. This is something, I don't know about you, but I imagine that for me it might be more difficult than you, because I am very much surrounded with Christians all the time. And for me it's a fight. And one thing that's helped me a great deal is to try to discern, for my own thinking at least, though some of my friends argue with me on my conclusions on this, the difference between a primary ministry and a secondary ministry. Now, I was in L.A. the month of May and helped train the counselors for the Graham Crusade, as I mentioned, that's going on now. And we had the second week, we had 15,000 people in attendance at the classes. That's all. We had 19 classes, that is, in 19 districts during the week, and that was the sum total. Well, some of my friends object when I say that that is not a primary ministry, teaching those counseling classes. That's a secondary ministry. To me, it is. Some aspects are primary, but to actually do counseling is a primary ministry. To teach others how to do it is a secondary ministry. And the reason I distinguish this in my own mind, it helps me to see whether my whole life schedule is taken up with secondary ministries of telling other people how to do it without being actively engaged in it, at least in some degree, myself. As I said yesterday, unless we do this, something begins to die down inside. And administrative responsibilities, the telephone, people, and everything, militate against the thing that our hearts desire. For some reason or other, the Lord has not, and I prayed a great deal about this, has not given me a successful ministry in my own hometown, Colorado Springs. I have a ministry, I teach a Sunday school class and this type of thing. But nothing that anywhere near begins to approach what I'd like to see. And also I checked it, I was just thinking on the way over, who am I going to get to take my Sunday school class since my assistant moved to Denver. I'll only be here about half the Sundays between now and the end of the year. So I traveled quite a bit. Well, how am I going to have a primary ministry when I'm traveling and visiting Navigator representatives? So in the struggle for this, something helped me. Now when I go, I try to spend 2.5 days in an area. That's sort of a standard pattern. The first evening, I like to spend with a representative and his wife. Then I ride ahead and I say to him, now on the second or third evening, I'd like you to have some kind of evangelistic thrust. Either you have some of your non-Christian neighbors over for dinner, or we'll go out to see them. I want you to set up some kind of evangelism that you can have in your area, and I want to participate in it. Well, of course, it does a couple things. If he isn't having much of an evangelistic thrust, he begins to get busy and figure out one. But also, it does something for me. I need this myself. for my own spiritual growth. Or you can set it up. We have lunch with somebody all the time. We'll say, well, look, why don't you bring one of your non-Christian friends? And the three of us will have lunch. But we need to make some way to make sure that this gets into our schedule. Maybe not as much as some others, but at least in type. So we keep our hand in it. Then he made many disciples. Paul preached the gospel, or they did, to that city. So did Jesus. He started out preaching the gospel. He made many disciples. So did Jesus. For what? For the building and the battle. To get into the warfare in which we are engaged. In case you didn't read it, in Christianity Today, in 61, there was an interview with Charles Malik. Dr. Malik, who at one time was the president of the United Nations General Assembly. He's from Lebanon. And one of the questions asked in the interview with him was this. What can Christians learn from the meteoric rise of world communism in little more than 40 years? And his answer is this. The most important thing to learn is that we are still living, as the Germans say, and I can't say what the Germans say. It's written here. Perhaps some of you could. But it means between the times. When demonic forces can quickly soar very high and can take possession of the world in very short order. If it isn't communism, it will be something else. This battle between Christ and the devil is an eternal thing until Christ comes again. Christians, therefore, should be alert. Christians cannot watch too closely. Christ told us to watch day and night. We don't know when he is coming again. The greatest lesson we can learn is that there is no security between the times, as word in quotes. No security whatever. Like what he's saying is that we are engaged in a spiritual battle between light and darkness, Christ and Satan, and Jesus is looking for disciples who will get into the battle, who will be faithful in the building and in the battle, in the spiritual warfare. So we're trying to train folks, get the kind of people who will get out in the battle. Someone has said that a church ought to be a beehive in reverse. And that is taking the honey out and not just bringing it all in. A couple of years ago, my brother, younger brother, really got moving for the Lord. He'd been a Christian for some years. I remember years ago when I was in Seattle and he came through in the Navy. He only visited my house once. He wrote me later and he said, Lorne, I'm not just ready for the things that you're talking about. But about 2.5 years ago, he went to a navigator conference out at Mount Hermon conference grounds. And he went into orbit and he's been going ever since. And he makes me feel like I'm standing still. And he was telling me about a year ago about his ministry. He went back into his church and he began to emphasize the importance of the word and quiet time and this kind of a thing. And his amazement, he discovered that the people he thought would back him up were the very ones who not only privately but publicly resisted him. Then one day he was having lunch, and a man and his wife came into this restaurant and said, "Hello, Leonard." And it was a fellow with whom he had worked a couple years before in the phone company, who'd moved away and since moved back. And after they talked for a while, the fellow said to my brother, he said, "Leonard, you know, there's something different about you. What's happened to you anyway?" My brother says, "Well, matter of fact, there is something different about me." He said, "Would you like to hear about it?" He said, "I would." He said, "Well, why don't you invite me over to your house one evening and I'll tell you about it." And he did. And that evening, both that man and his wife came to know Christ. And then he led some others to the Lord. And a couple other Christians were reactivated that he met in his business life and so on. And a year later, he went back to the same Mount Hermon conference with 8 people that he brought, half of whom he led to the Lord. But he said to me, "Lorne, there's something that's troubling me." He said, "I can't figure this out." He said, "Why is it that the ministry that I have and seemingly given of God is outside my church. Well, it troubled me too. And I thought about it for quite a while till I realized what was happening. Here's the church. And here are the eight people that my brother got going in the things of the Lord. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And I realize what's happened, and it seems to me that this is all too typical. That the church here, where he was a Sunday school superintendent, had drawn a circle around it and said that what happens here is the work of the church. And what is lacking is that what they ought to do is to draw a circle like this and says, this is also the work of the church because it is the work of the church. It's to get out in the building and in the battle. And so they've drawn their circle just too narrow. Now, of course, then the same could be said the other way around. My brother must be careful that he doesn't draw a little circle that just includes this. He's got to draw a circle that includes the whole thing, too. The purpose is for the building and for the battle. Well, when I copied these notes, I left out an important point here. I'm glad I thought of it. Help. How could have I missed that one? At least it's important to me. Acts 9:28. It says of Paul, and he was with them coming in and going out at Jerusalem. He was with them coming in and going out in Jerusalem. And I thought to myself, isn't that the basic idea? We're to come in for fellowship, for strengthening, for training, to get our wounds healed, and then get out into the battle. Come back in for refreshing, get out into the battle. In and out ought to be the picture, should it not? But if we keep coming in, we get spiritually surfeited. If we keep going out, we soon become dry. In and out. And so it seems to me that here is a practical illustration or application of the thought that if we actually have in mind to train disciples to be in the building and in the battle, it'll give us a better balance of in and out, in and out. Another thing it will help, it'll help us to realize that my brother, where does he need training? One of the big places he needs training is in the telephone company, because that's where he works. But what do? We want to bring him back here and give all of his training here in the study or in the Sunday school room, but that isn't where he works. Now, he needs us, but somebody's got to get out here on the job and help my brother to know how to live for Christ, to serve Christ in the telephone company. What about Jesus? What's one of the first things Matthew did? He got his friends together, and he got Jesus there. And so they could be in the presence of Jesus. But as I said the other day, or yesterday, it seems to me that the initial training of a disciple, as far as his ministry is concerned, should be in his sphere of influence, in his little world. Otherwise, he leaves that little world, he joins ours, and we lose that whole sphere of contact that he has. Well, what does this mean we have to do then? I've got to get out of my office, in my car, and out to where he is. For instance, Leroy Imes, who directs our work in the U.S., and Leroy's not right here, but there's a fellow I think, one of the greatest tacticians on evangelism that I know. I get invitations to come speak at this conference or that on evangelism, and I say, I'm not the man. Leroy Iams is your man. When Leroy first got his start, he went to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and he was to have a ministry to the college students at the University of Pittsburgh. He didn't know what to do, so the first thing he did was spend 3 weeks in prayer every day, all day. That's a pretty good way to start. I've had people say, well, Leroy Iams has a special gift. He's talented that way. I say, oh, no. That came to that fellow from agonizing, persistent prayer. Then God sent a man to town, and Leroy says, how do I go about reaching this campus? He said, all right, let's do this. The first thing they did was got in their car, and they went up on a hill alongside of Pittsburgh, and they prayed. They said, we're going to claim some promises for the University of Pittsburgh. And they did, and prayed. He said, now the next thing we're going to do is go down there. And so they did. They got in the car, went down to the university, parked the car, and just walked through the university. Sort of like every place that the sole of your foot shall tread upon, that have I given unto you, as I said unto Moses. Let's walk around this place and claim this for God. And I've since seen Leroy do this with others. For instance, one of our fellows wanted to get going on a certain campus, and Leroy said, I tell you what you do. You go over to the student union, and you order up a Coke, and you sit there for 2 hours every day for a full week. Just sit there. And he said, I'll dare say by the end of the week, you'll have some kind of an idea of what you could do. But isn't that a lot better than sitting at home in your bedroom or study trying to figure out how to reach that campus? Get out and sit where they sit. And I wonder sometimes if there isn't a psychological something that we are saying unknowing to our layman when we never show up at his place of business or at that factory. We are saying really that what you're doing out there is not really important. I told my wife, I said, when you remarry, be sure to get a man who's domesticated, who's handy with fixing things, who has a green thumb with the lawn, because I am none of these. I am none of these. And besides, I said to her one day a few years ago, I said, well, now I said, I believe the Lord gives gifts to people. I think I have a gift of administration, and some of the others don't. I could do that, and the others can do my lawn and can fix the faucets and a washing machine. And I think that on the surface of it, that's right. But you know what? I didn't realize what was happening. And over the years, nothing was said too much out loud about this. But then there was just a little, it didn't sound quite right what I was or was not doing around that house. And one day it struck me. You know what I was saying, in effect? I was saying, honey, what you're interested in is not really as important as my work. That's really what I would say. That home, that lawn, that washing machine, those faucets, that's her whole life. Now you take care of that, and I'll take care of this. And I thought, I think this is what we can be doing with our businessmen, our laymen. Say, well, if anything is important, you come down to my study. You come down to my home. It's all related to where I am. But suppose I get in the car and go down and have lunch with him. In his office, if we can. And pray right in his office. If not, let's get in the car right next to the factory or wherever he works. And then afterward, let's just walk around that place together and agree that we're just looking around to claim some souls for God in that place. I think he'd have a whole different outlook on that place as his mission field. These are just a few practical applications of the idea of training a disciple for what? For the battle and the building. He needs to go in and out, and I need to get in and out. Our fellows work on college campuses, so I need to get out on occasion in a campus, in a dormitory. I'm telling you, when I walk on a college campus, I feel much wider than I am. I feel 10 feet wide and 5 feet tall. I don't feel at ease on a campus anymore. But that's where our fellows work. And whenever I get out to San Diego or Norfolk, Virginia, I have the fellows try to arrange it so I can get out on a ship and be out there where some of our Christian fellows are. And then sit on that guy's bunk for a little while with him. And then listen to the blare of the radio and kind of get the feel all over again of when he's trying to study the Bible, when he's trying to meditate, what kind of an atmosphere is surrounding him. And that far better qualifies me than to make some suggestions over here to the Bible study that we're preparing for that fellow who's going to be doing it out on that ship in the noise of blaring radios. But I can forget about that whole world, can't I? Unless I get out there some in the battle. Now some thoughts on the matter of training leadership. After we have some converts and we disciple them, then from among the disciples, Jesus picked the 12, whom he named apostles. Now this is what Paul did too, didn't he? Take Acts 16, for instance, 1-3. Just let me read it here to you. Then came he to Derbe and Lystra, and behold, a certain disciple was there, named Timothy, which was well reported of by the brethren. Him would Paul have to go forth with him. From among the disciples, he picked up some leadership along the way. Well, what does that teach us? One thing that teaches us is to lay hands subtly on no man. I remember one of our representatives one day riding along in a bus, and he told me about a contact he'd made about a month before. He said, you know, he's the most enthusiastic fellow I've ever come across. Keen, alert. And I just sort of listened to him a little bit. And so he repeated it as though I hadn't gotten through to me. What a keen guy this was. And finally, sort of in exasperation, he said, well, isn't that good, Lauren? I said, I don't know, George, if that's good or not. I'll tell you better a year from now. I've seen a lot of people just go up in orbit and then flame out real quick. And others that were much slower getting started, but they stuck with it. And I think that if we would make sure, if we tried to pick our leadership from those who have demonstrated that they already know there's a battle on and are engaged in it and are already seeking to do what they can to build up the saints, I think we're going to have less heartache in our leadership. In my own observation, and I may be wrong on this, but in some churches at least, you know who the forgotten man is? The forgotten man is the fellow who doesn't need much help from anybody. The guy who doesn't cause any trouble. The man who's there when the church doors are open. The man who you can count on for any job. But what are we doing? We're running around mending broken fences, trying to put down a fire over here, like the islands that Howie was talking about the other night. And this fellow, who's ready for the leadership, the apostle category, if I could use it this, the Timothy category, he's the fellow that we're always going to get some time with next week or the week after, but he gets neglected because, he's the one guy that doesn't need my help. Yet he's the man who, if we spend a little more time with him now, would be ready the soonest to help us with some of these problem areas. And so, consequently, we don't have our leadership. Well, now, when Jesus chose the 12, for what did he choose them? For what purpose? Well, Mark 3:14. Now, for the next few moments, let's look at Mark 3:14, shall we? And he ordained 12 that they should be with him, and that he might send them forth to preach. He ordained 12 that they should be with him, and that he might send them forth to preach. Now it seems to me that they left their sphere of influence now and joined him in his life and his ministry. Now, there are others who wanted to go with Jesus, but he wouldn't let them. You take the illustration of the demoniac over here in Luke 8. Luke 8:38. It says, "Now the man out of whom the devils were departed besought him," Jesus, "that he might be with him." Now over here it says he chose 12 that they might be with him. Here's somebody who said he would like to be with him, be part of that group, but Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return to thine own house and show how great things God hath done unto thee." Well, did Jesus see in this man a man that wouldn't fit? Did he see here a man that was inferior? I don't think so. Because he went his way and published throughout the whole city how great things Jesus had done unto him. That's quite a witness. He said, "You go back to your sphere of influence. That is your place." Now, the 12 were called for a different purpose, to share his life and his ministry, to be with him, to share his life, to send them forth to preach, to share his ministry. You can't share his life and not share his ministry without being having so your head in the clouds, so of a mystic. And to try to share his ministry without sharing his life is certainly gross presumption, isn't it? You need both. Share his life, share his ministry. With him, out to preach. To share his life, what does that mean? Well, we're speaking now of training. I'm not speaking now of the deeper truths of Romans 6 and Galatians 2:20. But from the standpoint of training, what does it mean to have shared his life? Well, we've got a good illustration of this over in Luke 22, verse 28. Jesus said, "You are they which have continued with me in my temptations." You are they which have continued with me in my temptations. Now, what temptations is he talking about? Well, he isn't talking about the wilderness because he was alone there. What temptations is he talking about? I think he's talking about the testings that everyday life brought, with its pressures of mobs of people, with the criticisms, with those that lay wait for his life, and all that went with the pressure of the kind of a life that he lived and in which he involved them. You take the time that he said to them, "Come yourselves apart into a desert place and rest a while." And so they went out into the desert place, and lo, what happened? 5,000 people met him. So they came to the Lord and they said, "Now, Lord, this is a desert place." Remember they said that? Well, didn't he know they were in a desert place? He was there. He could see that. But they were trying to call to his mind what he'd said. "Come you apart into a desert place and rest a while." Hoped he'd get the point. This is a desert place, and the time is now past. The office hours are over. I mean, the study is closed. My office is shut. Send the multitude away that they may go into the villages and get themselves something to eat. He said, "No, you feed them." "Well, we can't feed them. Besides, there goes our 3-day holiday." "All right." He said, "Well, what have you got?" "We'll make them sit down." So they sat him down. "You feed them." So they fed him. After this was all over, he put him in a boat to row at the other side of the lake. And then what happens? A storm comes up. And then the scripture says they're out there toiling and rowing. It had been a rough day. No vacation. They'd gotten out galley west. And as far as I could see, they never did get it, as far as Mark records it. Now, I know we've got to have time apart, someone said, or you'll come apart. But the point is that they shared with him the pressures, the trials, the difficulties, the heartaches, the joys that everyday life brought. Matthew 26:39 is another illustration of this. It says of Jesus, and he went a little farther and fell on his face and prayed. He left the multitude out here. And then, you know, he took the 11. Then, in that context, he took the 3 a little farther, Peter, James, and John. And to them he said, my soul was exceeding sorrowful. And then he went a little farther and fell on his face and prayed. Now he could take the 11 farther than he could take the multitude. And he could open his heart to the 11 in a way he could not to the general public. But to the 3 he said, my soul is exceeding sorrowful. He could open his heart to the 3 in a way that he couldn't to all 11. And yet he himself, of course, had to go on a little farther. And so do we. But here are the 3, or you could say the 12. You could bring them, well, here this case is the 11. You could open his heart to them in a way that he couldn't anybody else. Now, what I want to point out here is that if we are going to have loyal leadership, a friend that loves all times, a brother who's born for adversity, then we need not first to share our ministry, but first we must share our lives with them. Commandant Shoup of the Marine Corps wrote this, and this is a Marine general, the head of the Marine Corps. Many times I have said that I have no trouble finding people to handle machines. The problem is to find people who can handle people. Concentrate on Marines. They handle the machines. This problem warrants the undivided attention of all echelons of command and of every individual. Why the individual? Simply because each of us must first learn to command himself before aspiring to command others. Too many take too long to learn this lesson. By the words, with all thy getting, get understanding, surely it was meant the understanding of boys and girls, men and women, of human beings. Then here's what he says. Do you search the faces of your men every day? Do you know their problems? Are you helping them? The trouble is that all too often those who are in charge of others don't counsel them at the opportune time to properly help them in their personal problems. Here comes the treasurer. What do we see when we see the treasurer of our church? The dollar signs? What are we waiting for? The treasurer's report? Have you ever shared your life with him? Do you know what his problems are? Do you know what's behind that, his face? You say, of all people that ought to know what the person's problems are, it's the pastor. But I'll dare say that some of the top people, the Sunday school superintendent, the chairman of the deacon's board, are oftentimes the ones, and I know because I've interviewed them, that every time they've gotten together, it's been on business. They have shared the ministry of the church with them, but the pastor has not actually shared his life with them, first of all. I remember one, I went to this church for 4 days, and I interviewed the various people. Here was the Sunday school superintendent. And I was to talk with him about the Sunday school and all. And it didn't take me long to find out that one of the greatest things that was on his heart was a sick child they had. Well, it just happened that in our home we have a couple of kids that are diabetics and developed it a couple of years ago. And I know that after all the excitement is over and this settles down to the day-by-day routine of carefully controlled diets, daily shots, and all the little things of when the kids have a party and this little one can't have the Cokes like the rest. That's daily life. And so we talked together about this. And I was amazed to discover that he inferred, at least, that I was the first person that really sat down and to whom he'd ever been able to share his heart concerning the concern of his wife and himself for that little child. Because every other time, apparently, when he was talked to, it was about how can we build up the Sunday school. What was the report last year? and with the fellows who help me. I can only work with so many people regardless of how big this navigator work gets. But I have to share my life with them if I'm going to expect them to share their life with me and share my ministry and share their ministry together. And this is a costly thing. This thing we don't want to do. This thing because it can hurt our hearts. This is a thing because the very people who get closest to us might drift off. And also the very things that we've shared our hearts on, they may use later to throw back at us. There's every reason in the world not to do it. But I am convinced that we will not build real, dynamic, vital, reliable leadership until we learn to share our lives with them. Right here at this Glen, we bring in here and make part of our staff young kids. They work in our bookkeeping department. My salary, everything that we spend goes through that. And we've got kids that know what's going on. And I tell you, when you open up your whole inside working to others, sometimes you get a little weary of that. You just saw they didn't know what was going on. But it's a basic principle that if we want these trainees to share our ministry, we've got to be willing to share our lives. In a navigator area, when a man has some young fellows that they're going along quite well and are ready for it, they move into the home. And many of our area representatives have 3, 4, 5, and 6 fellows living in the home, young men. And I know something about this. That's not easy, to open up your family circle. That's a rough go. And there are a lot of problems involved with it. What about the training of the children? What about your family life? But I tell you, we have found it one of the most effective training of close-in leadership that we have ever come across. And today, the closest friends that my wife and I have are the men and the women who lived in our home over the years. And at the time when they were there, we had some rough times. But it built something that's absolutely nothing can break. So I'm saying that if we're going to be building some leadership, let's not lay hands suddenly on any man. Let's make sure they have demonstrated their discipleship. But when we're ready to pick them, let's bring them in close and be willing then to open our hearts to them in a way that perhaps we are not free to open to others. Now I'll grant you there are some things that you cannot share with anybody. And of course that's what makes the ministry a little lonely. And there we can thank God if we have a friend from another town or another church or somebody that we can have a buddy with. But still there's a long way that we can go. Then we're ready for him to share our ministry. And so this is what Jesus did. That he first involved them in his ministry and then he sent them out on their own to new spheres of influence. He ordained 12 that they might be with him and that he might send them forth to preach. Now there's one more thing. I can't nail this one down to an exact scripture. I suppose if I looked I could. But they were not only chosen to be with him, but also to be with one another. And that is a whole story in addition. You know that. For instance, I have 6 men, let me see, 7 assistants. You see, I could keep the relationship with each one of these men personally and open my heart to them, and they with me, and as I get with each of these fellows. But you know, it's a horse of a different color entirely than to band them together so that they are not only tied to me as the leader, but as to one another. Isn't that right? To take your key people in your church and to band them together into a unit with a single purpose and objective in mind. That's an important thing. And as we consider navigator representatives, we want, first of all, that a man is good seed. That is, that the saving life of Christ is welling up within, and all that that involves. Secondly, that he can go into an area or a pool of manpower, come up with some converts, and out of this some disciples. That he can work with people individually. But another stage is, we ask ourselves, can this man take a handful of people and band them together to accomplish an objective? And we have people that are excellent individually, but they can't band them together. It's much more difficult. Do I have to tell you that? You know, I can take comfort in something. It says, isn't it absolutely astounding, as you have experience in life, that you find that whatever it is, Jesus in fact does sympathize. He does know what our problems are. Take this one, for instance. Here it is, the Last Supper. He's worked with them for 3 years. Pretty soon he's going to be taken away from them. And on the night of the Last Supper, there are two things that concern them. Over in Luke 22, Jesus said, "But behold, the hand of him that betrays me is with me on the table. And truly the Son of Man goes as it was determined. But woe unto that man by whom he is betrayed." It says, "And they began to inquire among themselves which of them it was that should do this thing." I wonder who that could be. I wonder who that cur is. Who could stoop as low as to do that? A little buzzing around him. Who's the lowest among us that would do that? And then it says in the very next verse, "And there was also a strife among them, which of them should be accounted the greatest." The Last Supper, the last night, 3 years, two concerns. Who's the lowest? Who's the highest? And whenever Christians get together in any group, you can be pretty sure that there's an inner underneath this. There, it's there. That's the old nature. Sin hit us a terrible lick. Who's the lowest? Who's the highest? An announcement is made here at the Glen. What's the first thought? How does that affect me? Will I go up or down? Where am I on the chart? Announcement's made in church. New policy. How does that affect me? What about so and so? Who's the lowest? Who's the highest? Why is this? I believe that one of the most used tools on Satan's workbench is a wedge. Because Jesus said that if two of you, just two, not only this 12, but if two of you shall agree on earth as touching anything that they shall ask, it shall be done for them of my Father which is in heaven. And when you go down and you kneel down in the office of one of your church members, you are already, you and your man, a band of men, the least common denominator. And Jesus said, if you two agree on earth as touching anything you shall ask, it shall be done of my Father. And you could open up right there in that office and say, let's claim this today, shall we? And let's ask God to give you a witness and in due time some converts right here in this place. Here's a promise from God. What a power. A young fellow and his two buddies, new Christians, started at Texas A&M a few years ago. They didn't know what to do, so the three of them just got together for prayer and reading of the Word every noon. In the next year and a half, they averaged 2 converts a week. I tell you, there is tremendous power in a band of men. I had lunch with a pastor a few years ago. We sat down and said, "Lauren, what's the greatest thought you've had in the last 2 years?" I sputtered and I didn't have any. But I can tell you right now that if you ask me what's the greatest thought that you've had in the last 2 years, it's the tremendous potentiality and power of a band of men. I think it's the secret of the penetration of the gospel into a given segment of society. A band. Not only is there tremendous power, but what about the tremendous promise? Well, where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst. Also, I think that a band of men is a secret to our administrative problems. It's a burden lifter. I was asked by Dr. Vernon Grounds of the Baptist Seminary in Denver when I'd come up and speak to the faculty and some of the alumni there and some friends on what makes a successful pastor and why do they hit the skids. But you know, I came across something in 2 Chronicles 26 that I think I know what makes a successful pastor or a successful Christian worker. It's the story of Zechariah. Just let me read two verses. You don't have to turn to it. 2 Chronicles 26:5. It says, "And he sought God in the days of Zechariah, who had understanding in the visions of God. And as long as he sought the Lord, God made him to prosper." God makes a successful pastor. God makes a successful Christian worker. And then in the 11th verse it says, "Moreover, Uzziah had an host of fighting men that went out to war by bands." It's his people that make a successful pastor. It's the people that make a successful Christian worker or Christian leader. And this is what we're praying for and working for. A host of fighting men who get out of the battle and who went out to war by bands. There's extra power in this man of a band. But you know this. In fact, our whole organizational structure is based on that idea. Just right on down to the lawn crew with his band of men. Out on a ship, a guy with his band of men. A man with his men. Well, we've got a couple of minutes here. I wanted on these, although I don't know as it necessarily warrants it, to have any time for just a few minutes for questions along any of these lines, because I don't know how much time we're getting to talk here. Let's take a couple minutes. Does anybody want to challenge anything I've said or clarify or preach a little sermonette or ask some question? We've got about 3 minutes here. Yes. Oh, that's 2 Chronicles 26:11. Mm-hmm. By the way, why they hit the skids is also in that same chapter toward the end. In case you, the other half of that sermon, in case you want an outline on one. Any question? Yes, John?
I was wondering about this matter of intimacy with leadership. In the service, of course, between commission officers and army enlisted men, there is the rapport of keeping him aloof because intimacy breeds contempt. How do you relate this with what you just said?
Well, I was just reading the training manual for officers. And I was reading a paragraph where it pointed out how important it is for the officer to be involved in the personal problems of his men, and particularly to get involved in the significant aspects of a man's life, his marriage, his birthday, the birth of children. And so apparently, I would say that it seems to me that there really isn't a problem there. Now, I know we had some seminary professors here once, and we were talking about this. They said, well, if we get in those spaces with our students, won't this eliminate this a proper relationship? Won't they get sort of slap me on the back and kind of, hey, Mac, type of an approach? Well, I haven't seen it so, really. Now, I think one of the differences is here, when I think of fellowship with a person, I don't think of just kind of a glib little telling the latest jokes. I think that involved in this is sharing of the scripture, of praying together. I know, for instance, I take the assistants. We call ourselves the assistants who help me. And every 3 months we go away for 2 days. And to pray, plan, and play together. And one thing we do is we've taken the time, and we haven't gotten clear around yet, to have a fellow take an evening. Say, Rod, tell us about your whole life. Tell us about where you are, your parents, where you were born, what your interests were, how you came to know the Lord. And you know, it's fantastic what a new appreciation you get of a person when he tells you of his struggles. And the trouble that Rod had with cigarettes for 2 years after he came to work with the Navigators. We didn't know about it. And this trouble, the struggle he had with drink. That guy is a walking miracle. Oh, and when we have a staff member, I've been puzzling over for a couple of years. What's wrong? There's something about this fellow. He's loyal to a fault. You ask him to do something, and he does that regardless. Well, that's all right, except that's not good. He keeps saying to me, Lauren, what do you have in your heart for my area? And I said, it isn't what I have in my heart. What do you have? Well, I learned one day that when he was 7 years of age, he stood on the courthouse steps while his mother drove off with another man and yelled at him and says, I don't want anything to do with you. Well, that put a wound deep down in that fellow's heart and life that helps me to understand today better and to appreciate. And the fact that I know this doesn't make me look down. It elevates. Or just like the time when you have to get up, suppose you lied to your deacons. You ever done that? Well, I've caught myself. I've had to stand up and maybe it wasn't intentional, maybe it was halfway. Now, that's where you get caught. So you get up and you admit it. Does that lower you? Or you have someone with whom there's a real struggle. And you get together and you have a real open-hearted thing. And you think it's going to split you, but it draws you together. So I have found, you take Jesus, didn't he live with them and walk with them and eat with them and sleep with them? Wasn't his life wide open? But that apparently didn't happen to him.
God's life for all brethren, regardless of the office you hold. The office of the minister should be the highest in the church. Yet, the minister merits no more respect than his life deserves. If you want to respect your people, you must gain it by their love, regardless of what your life is.
Matthew 23:8 says, but be not ye called rabbi, for one is your master, even Christ, and all ye are brethren. I heard someone say that you could say, this means all you are buddies. Buddies. I feel like a buddy with all our staff, just buddies. We go fishing together. We do this, that, and the other together. Now, there are certain things that I happen to know that because of confidence and all, I couldn't share with the other fellows. But there is a mutual confidence there. Like with my wife. I don't tell her everything, neither does she tell me everything. But there's nothing between us. And she has respect for me, I believe. But it seems to me that the respect is lost if there's a flaw somewhere. Like the man that's not the head of his home. You can't figure out why in the world, why is it? He goes so far in spiritual things, he's not the head of his home, you don't know what it is. But you don't know what happened in his bedroom. Maybe he's a veritable beast. And this lack of godliness in that realm could just siphon away any respect she had for that husband of hers. Or you take children. What about this matter with children? Particularly you have Christian homes. What happens? Oftentimes I think it can be traceable to a very glaring flaw in the consistency or the godliness of that home. And I'll grant you that when you get an opening your heart to people, it's a very leveling thing. It's a very leveling thing. I'll preach a little sermon on this. There's only one basis for it. That's 1 John 1:7. That if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship one with another, and the blood of Jesus Christ, his Son, cleanses us from all sin. I can't have fellowship with you on the basis of how righteous you are. It's not how I walk, it's where I walk. If I walk in the light, if I walk in such a way to be willing to let my life be open, to take the roof off, to let the walls down, then we can have fellowship with one another. And the blood of Jesus Christ cleanses us from all sin. If you ought to read the Escape from Loneliness by Dr. Tournier, the Swiss Christian psychiatrist, who points out this are secrets that separate us. And you see, the navigators, we can't have a cohesive staff on the basis of an objective, or man-to-man, or follow-up, or scripture memory, or anything else. Only on one basis, the fact that you and I are sinners. And I needed to use 1 John 1:9 this week, and you needed to use 1 John 1:9 this week. And if it's based on how righteous I am, all the rest, it's on a wrong basis, and it'll never stand the test of the long haul. Because I'm not getting better, I'm getting worse. It seems like there's more sins that plague me today, and things that I thought I had victory over 15 years ago return to plague me again. Temper. What about the eyes? I thought that when I fought this thing through in the 20s, the 40s would be easier, and the 40s are worse. Well, now, if the buddies that I have that work with Rod Sargent and Leroy Imes and Jim Downing, if our basis isn't on 1 John 1:7, then we're in bad shape. Because I can't hold out that long. They're going to find out sooner or later. So there's an openness between us that I think is a basis for this kind of a thing. We have been told in the navigators, where do you get that discipline? You must have a tough, hard-nosed discipline. One fellow said, the loyalty of your staff is almost all awesome. Others have said, well, looking on the outside, you must have some way of really keeping these guys in line. They miss the whole point. Our area representatives go out and raise their own money, their own support, do their own work. They say, well, how can you control your men if you don't pay their salary? Well, I say if it's on the basis of their salary, it's on the wrong basis. There is a spiritual rapport, there is a spiritual tie that's built up with this openness, one with another, and honesty, that just, it becomes like nylon cord. And I think a lot of us are afraid of this. But it doesn't. And what happens, I was going to get into this, a band of men must be willing to lay down their lives for one another. That's the kind of a band we're looking for. And therefore, there's the outflow of love and heart and understanding and concern that my first concern is not myself, but the men that God's given me. And their families. But we're afraid of this involvement. I've talked with Christian businessmen in town, owner of their business. I said, do you get involved with the family affairs of your employees? Oh, no, not me. I said, why not? I don't want to get involved in that. I said, look, just from a business standpoint, you're losing money. Because here's a man who's fighting with his wife. He slams the door at home and he comes down to your place and maybe puts on a smile, hi, and talks to you and he walks into work. But down inside, he's all eaten up. Is he concentrating on his work? He's going to bungle jobs. He's going to break things. You're losing money from a dollars and cents standpoint. And then you say you're a good businessman. Not only a good businessman, but say nothing about a Christian. And there's something else. You ask somebody in your church to do something, and he's got two reasons for his answer. The real one, and the one that sounds good. Right? When I make a decision, should I make a trip around the world? Should I go to Europe? I think, now, does our work over there need it? Can I be spared here from the office? And I go through these, and maybe I list them. Maybe I talk them over with the fellas. But to be very honest, there's another factor, too. Tugs away at my heart. I think, now there's my wife. We've got two diabetic children. When one of them gets sick, she can be in the hospital in 24 hours. Well, let's see, should I leave her? Is she well enough taken care of? Now, maybe I wouldn't come out and say that, see? But that's a stronger reason in my life as the need in Europe. And I really have to get before the Lord on this. So I'm saying that I believe that with working with men who are going to be close to us, we're operating about half knowledge, half speed, and all the rest because we don't share our lives as well as our ministries. We don't know our people. And the closer they get to us, and the more we depend on them, the more time we need with them, and not the less. And the more certain we must be that we cannot rest if we think there's anything between us. We cannot stand it. But we get together and ask about it and pray about it and get on our knees together. This is the costly part of leadership, and not many are willing to pay that. And I'll have to admit sometimes I get sick of it when I get tired. And someone, and I think, oh, is there never any end? But then I get like Moses. Did I bear all these people? Did I do this? I told somebody once, you know, I'm so tired, I think I'm going to turn this work over to the Lord and let him run it for a while. I get feeling better, I'll take it back again. I put this down on my notes, but I wasn't going to, but you brought it to my mind. You know, one of the reasons we don't want to do this is Psalm 55. We don't want that to happen to us, and I don't want it to happen to me. And once in a while, I have thought to myself over the 20 years or so I've served the Lord, I'm not going to let myself get too close to anybody. I've said this because I've gotten hurt a few times. And you know what the psalmist said? For it was not an enemy that reproached me, then I could have borne it. Neither was it he that hated me that did magnify himself against me. Let the townspeople cry, let the wolves bark, the outsiders. That isn't what tears me apart. He says, then I would have hid myself from him. But it was thou, a man mine equal, my guide, and mine acquaintance. We took sweet counsel together, and we walked unto the house of God in company. You're the one that slandered me. That's why it's so hard for me. That's what tears me up inside. And we get burned and hurt a few times. Then we want to draw back into our shell and keep aloof. But you know what happens? There's a little more of a separation, a little more of a wall. Constantly then between them. And first thing, they were more alone and more alone and more alone. See, love must make itself vulnerable. Love must offer itself without any offer of recompense. And therefore, love can be rebuffed. And we don't want to be rebuffed. That's why we don't want to extend love. That's why people don't want to witness. Because they're afraid they'll be rejected. And we don't like to be rejected. And that's the costly part of this, isn't it? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to get into all this on that simple question, John. Let's pray.